Welcome to this lecture on virtual machines. So, last time we started to look at multi-threaded programs, and the first attempt is, as always, we kind of try to reuse whatever we have learned about virtual machines. So we need a code area. We want to have a memory, and inside the memory a stack. And now at that point we are already a little bit doomed, because if we have a multi-threaded program, we cannot do with a single thread, because with a single stack, because every thread might have its own stack, and so we require a set of stacks. And together with a heap area where shared data can be, where dynamic data can be allocated. And therefore, we came up with at least a conceptual memory organization like that, this blue area. And please notice that we do not... So it looks as if it were a two-dimensional array, which can grow, which is unbounded in every dimension, and so in practice, no such thing exists. We always have a linear memory, and so it will be an extra task to realize such a stack of stacks inside a linear memory. So that is one thing. The other thing which we might recall is what you have to do when you program with POSIX threads, for example. If you do that, then whenever you create a thread, you a priori have to kind of communicate to the runtime system how much stack space will be consumed by the thread. And then the runtime system will provide a block. That's it. So that's the implementation of this stack of stacks given through by POSIX threads. And it's a little bit difficult, because the usual programmer does not really know how much stack space a thread needs. How much stack space does a single procedure call need? And how deep will be the recursion? All that we do not know, but we should know when we use POSIX threads. And I don't know really what people do there. Probably they just do mention something which seems to them appropriate, and then they run the program and see whether any of the threads will run into problems. And if not, they are happy. Yeah. So in that sense, we kind of will later think about how to implement this stack of stacks. And the reason why I have put all that into this blue area is that in the C-like environment, there is a uniform address space. So therefore, they must reside within the same address space somehow. And yeah, so you cannot kind of have a separate address counter, say, for the heap, and for each step a stack individually. Why? Because you can subtract pointers, and that gives you the number of cells in between. And if you kind of have two different counters, then you could subtract a stack address from a heap address, and by chance they could be the same, and then you get the value zero as the difference. Also, they are not the same. Yeah, and that's kind of problematic. So, okay. And then there's something which we also do here. So what we have also maintained for the implementation of C, and also this C plus minus thing, that we had an EP, an extreme pointer, and now I am a little bit tired of extreme pointing, and so I give it up. So one could do it also with the extreme pointer, but there are some reasons why it is might be useful to give it up, and that me and in real C implementations it is also might it is this maybe I have already mentioned that this extreme pointer is often not there, and that means if the stack by chance grows too much and hits the into the heap, then so bad luck. Yeah. And that means, but usually this bad luck is not, so the program then is completely bogus, program execution will typically very quickly notice that something went wrong and you get a seg fault. So now if we have not a single, so also I kind of last time kind of explained that we will use a single core implementation. We might wonder what to do with doing a multi-core implementation of that. But for a single core implementation, but in all cases, it could be the case, since the hardware resources are limited, that there are more threads which could run than there are cores to execute. And so all these kind of possibly running threads must be kind of maintained somewhere. And for that, we provide a ready queue. That's our way to deal with it. And I guess this is an operating system thing. I guess the hardware also provides such a thing like a ready queue. And so how do we realize? So for that we have to speak about threads, and we have to refer to individual threads and their resources. How can we do it? So one way, so the way we deal with it is that we equip every thread with a unique thread ID. That is also something which is provided by POSIX threads and probably also by operating system threads. And now this thread ID allows us to speak about different threads, and allows us to index some table with this thread ID. And inside this table, we can store all relevant information about the thread. So, and that is, this table is the, I call it TTAP. Not to compare it with TTIP. but a TTAP, which is a thread table. And that is the now, So and so that is this one, and one thread is currently running, and all others, which could run but are currently not running, will have to be maintained in some queue, and the thread ID of the currently running thread, for that we might again provide a register to hold it. That is the CT register, the currently running thread. And then we might provide a function self, which returns the thread ID of the currently running thread. And that is implemented. Well, it should return the content of this register CT. We have not yet we have no such instruction so far, so we provide a new instruction. This is this instruction self, which just returns the content of that register. Yeah. So in a POSIX thread implementation, I guess there's something like a currently running thread. There's probably just a global variable holding that value. Okay, so then now what about the other possibly running threads? And these kind of will be maintained in some, we don't know how many these are, so we maintain them in a dynamic data structure, and that is the ready queue. And so then this is a data structure which we need an implementation. This is a part of the runtime of the runtime. We could create it outside of the memory space, but thinking of POSIX thread library, this is kind of just a C program consisting of C functions and C data structures, and I guess there it is simply within the memory space. But we could think of this thread, this ready queue also as something outside our virtual machine, and but part of the runtime system. And okay, that's the ready queue, and then for that we need to, since it's kind of an abstract data type, and we need an NQ and a DQ function. And when I said queue, then there is kind of the implicit assumption that we have that we use kind of a FIFO discipline. Threads which have become first ready will run first, and when another one is entered, then it will kind of has to wait until all the existing threads have run. And so, but that is, and again, this is could be part of a, could, we could think of that as a debatable, because in the real world, you might equip every thread also with a priority, and that means that you would kind of have to exchange the ready queue by some ready priority queue, so that higher priority threads might run more often or first, and then the lower priority threads. Okay, so that is what the picture which we have here with the thread table, and there the current thread and the threads from the ready queue. And when we enqueue a new thread, so this thread with thread ID 13. Then that means it is put in the end. And if we dequeue, then that means that CT receives the value, the first element from the ready queue, which is this one. And if a call to this dequeue, now we have kind of have to make an agreement. How should the runtime system notice that the ready queue is empty? And that could be, so here we will do it in such a way that it will return a negative value. So this is again something which is not, the dequeue. The DQ will, that is our convention, that thread IDs are non-negative, and if DQ as a function returns a value which is negative, then we know that there was no thread. There would be other possibilities. We could kind of make it in such a way that this DQ is a procedure in that sense, so at least it does not return the function, but simply directly puts the first element into the current thread variable, but has a status value which is returned, and then we could kind of check the status, the return status, whether there was something to return or there was nothing to return. Okay, so but here we just take that approach by letting DQ be a function and checking the non-availability of a thread by checking for negativity. Okay, so that was kind of how we deal with how the runtime system may deal with the ready queue. Then the question is, and then I also already said, the thread table will maintain for every thread the relevant information. Now, what is the relevant information for a thread? So we might think of, we have one thread running, and now we switch to another thread. So what kind of information do we have to save about that thread? So, and what I claim, at least for our virtual machine, it is sufficient to save the stack pointer, the PC and the frame pointer. The stack pointer and the frame pointer identify kind of the stack frame where of that particular thread, namely the top element, the top of that stack frame, and the starting address of that stack frame. So that's perfect, because and the PC tells us where to continue with when that thread again is going to run. And so in some sense, now, so that is for our virtual machine. In principle, you might think of whenever you kind of do a context switch from one thread to another, you have to, there is always kind of a working set of which determines that thread, and that working set typically consists of the registers occupied by that thread. Okay, so interrupting the current thread therefore will require, so we have to save these values. We feed this working set into the thread table, and so that when we kind of restart or continue with that thread, we may recover the thread state before the interrupt. So that is, therefore, we save then these three registers to the corresponding entries of the thread table, and so say in at locations 1, 0, 1, and 2, SP, PC, and FP. So this is the save operation. And likewise, we have a restore, so which kind of takes these three values from the thread table and puts them again into the registers. So this is this operation here. And then once we have the save and restore, we immediately can kind of realize a now programming level function or procedure, and that is this yield. What does the yield do? So it's not easy to explain what a yield does, because a yield in some sense does nothing. It should have no impact. The only impact of the yield is that it affects the scheduler. So that means it says, okay, I'm a friendly thread, and I say, okay, I'm at a point in time where I may allow another thread to run. And then this yield, writing yield, would then interrupt my computation. This means my thread state is saved into the thread table, and my thread ID is enqueued into the ready queue, and the first element from the ready queue is extracted and put into the counter and is then kind of activated. So here is therefore how it was. So how this context switch is implemented. So the first thing is we check whether there's something in the ready queue. If there's nothing in the ready queue, if there's nobody, no other thread waiting for or kind of ready for running but not running, if there is no one, I do nothing. That's it. So if there's someone, so this I can check looking at the return value, and if this is zero or larger than zero, then I know, okay, there is a CT is the thread ID of a possibly running thread. Then I save my current registers. I enqueue the current thread into the ready queue. I put the extracted thread into the current thread register, and then I restore. And this restore, this restoring has no arguments. But it takes its argument from the current thread register, and the same was the case for the save operation, which also refers to the current thread. Okay, so in this sense, In this way, the yield operation implements a context switch. Okay. So now that was the operation yield, and now we may a little bit reason about yield and about the scheduler. And so perhaps one more thing to say. So we have this current thread, which is, so we might wonder how that yield would operate in a multi-threaded environment. So in a multi-threaded environment, we would need not a current thread, but an array of current threads, and that is indexed by the cores. So we would have five. If we have eight cores, then we would have an array of size of length eight. And so the saving executed by a core would kind of say save to individually for each core. So it might so the save kind of must be called then with the number of the core, so that the corresponding the right thread ID could be extracted, and then to the right element in the thread table could be accessed. So we have to make sure then that the data structures, which is the ready queue and which is the thread table, these are shared data structures. And therefore, we must make sure that these data structures are thread safe. For the thread table, it might not be a problem. Why? Different cores run different threads, and so therefore they will access different entries in the T tab, and that is, we could think of that accesses to different entries do not create a conflict. So that would be no problem, but the ready queue constitutes a problem, because the ready queue then is shared, and so there is could be several cores who want to extract something out of the ready queue, and that means we have to provide some kind of protection mechanism to the ready queue so that these accesses are mutually exclusive. So this would be the extra complication which we would have to add. Okay, now let's go on, and then assuming that for simplicity, we have a single core and we run our threads, and we have 20 threads in our ready queue. So what can we do? So what should we do? A single core and 20 threads to execute. So we could take an optimistic point of view that every thread runs to completion, and if the programmer wants to provide some kind of fair scheduling, then the programmer has to care himself or herself for fairness. And that he could do by kind of putting yields, sufficiently many yields, into his or her program. That we could do. So that is, in that sense, the compiler is on the safe side, and the runtime system, because we don't have to do anything. The other thing is, if the implementation is meant to provide non-trivial guarantees. So, for example, we might want the runtime system to guarantee that each executable thread has a fair chance to be completed. And that means every thread must be former or later scheduled for running, And that means every thread, former or later, must be interrupted. In particular, threads running infinitely long must be interrupted at some point. And so how can we achieve that? So that, so one possibility is that we, that is the optimistic point of view. So we assume that the programmer has guaranteed that, and the compiler or the runtime system does nothing. The other thing is that we could kind of do not trust the programmer, but insert yields automatically. And now the question is where and how many yields do we insert? One possibility is that we insert a switch, a thread between two threads after every instruction. So that means we do an addition and then switch, and another addition and then, and that's kind of a little bit stupid because then the system is mainly concerned with switching, and that means program execution is tremendously slowed down. So that is perhaps not a good idea. So therefore, another thing is, another option is that we kind of say, okay, every thread has a time slice. And that means it can run for, say, 1,000 steps, and then the next thread is going to run. So that means we have also kind of to slow down the program execution, because at every step we have to additionally increment the counter. But the counter could be in a register, so maybe that individual instruction, this individual increase might not so expensive, but still it would be rather expensive. And then there is a third possibility that we say, okay, so that it only, we could kind of look at the program, and then it turns out that it suffices to insert thread switches only at specific program points. Namely, we have only to insert as many switches so that we kind of avoid infinite program execution. So in every possibly infinite run of a program should former or later hit the switch, context switch. And now what happens if the program is executed infinitely long? Well, then it means either the program went into an infinite loop or into any loop, or there's a recursion. And therefore, it suffices to break these loops. So this we can do in the following way. We could place a context switch at the beginning of function bodies, and then before every jump whose target does not exceed the current PC. So we could also, instead of putting it at the beginning of function bodies, we could do it like that. Whenever we have a call, and the call is to a function with a larger, where the start point is larger, so which is ahead, we do nothing. But when the start point is smaller than the current PC, then we kind of execute the switch. So that would be the implementation of the idea that whenever we go to something, make a jump back, then we insert a context switch, and that is, we might hope that this is a much rarer event. In fact, what we even more could do is that from these jump backs, we do not kind of do a context switch at every jump back, but say only every hundredth jump back or so. So that we additionally have a counter together with this jumping back, and that would be kind of the, then we would We do not have to modify the counter all the time, but only in few places, and the jumping is an even rarer event, and so then the cost of context switching would be decreased in a maximal way. So let us see what kind of how we would, if we do that, just if we insert a yield before jumping back, this would mean for the while loop that we could have here whenever here at the end of the body before we jump back, then there we would kind of insert the yield. And so that would mean in particular so here for the do while loop we would kind of if we would have to do something else, so that it's not at the end of the body, but we could do it at the end of the body, but we could do it even at the end of the condition before jumping back. And since every loop should contain such a context switch, we could kind of reduce the number of context switches, for example, if we do loop unrolling, which is an optimization which people like to do anyway, and that would also reduce then the number of context switches. So then there's a kind of we have kind of a little bit of trouble if the code is not generated by the compiler, but so it's kind of freehand code, because then you can use all kind of things which can produce jumps doing weird control flow, for example, by using this jump I index jump or this and using them in a free way, we might introduce extra unconventional loops, and there we must take care that either we do not trust these instructions and then put a context switch before each of these instructions. So that would be one alternative. Okay, so that was the how we can deal with the how we can insert enough yield operations without trusting the programmer to do so. And that is definitely convenient, because typically programmers like to think in individual threads and program these, and not when kind of keeping in mind all running threads and to check where and how and in which way to insert the yield operations. Okay, so that was kind of when once the all threads are running, then we might wonder about the scheduling, but before multiple threads run, we first must be able to create. So that means any reasonable system of threads, of multi-threading, must provide a method to create and spawn and start new threads. And here we kind of do it, and we provide in simplification of the API provided by POSIX threads, we provide a thread create. And so here we only have two arguments. The first one should provide a function, and the second an argument, and the function is applied to the argument. So for the real POSIX thread, you have more arguments. I guess one is this size of the stack space, and I guess you have there are extra arguments. I think one is about the priority and things to affect the scheduling. So, but here we kind of have the simplistic view of have the minimal number of arguments which are necessary here. And this argument now, so this create function, so the one question is what kind of type should E0 and E1 have. So if E1 is a generic argument, so what is the generic type in C? What do you use there always? The void star. So it's a pointer to a void, and that means you provide the argument by a pointer, and if you want to have multiple arguments, you have to provide a struct or something, or an array, and then put a pointer there, and then the E1, which is a function, so this must be a function which takes an argument, which is a void star pointer, and returns, what does it return? So it returns, so that we might wonder what we do with the return value of the function. So, okay. So that is now in C, we call this create, and then a thread is created. That is our naive point of view. But in the real world, thread creation could fail. Why could thread creation fail? So there could be many reasons, but one reason is, for example, that the memory is exhausted because we have to allocate the new stack, and there might be no possibility to provide a new stack. That could happen, and then the thread creation would fail, and we return -1. Here in this case, I'm not so sure what they would return in the reality, but I guess it's something similar, so there's an error code, and otherwise you receive as a return value the new thread ID of the thread created. And that means you do the create, you kind of save it somewhere, and then you may check there whether this is really, whether a thread has been created. So then, what are the tasks which we have to do when we want to implement that thread create? So first, we have to evaluate the arguments. Then we have to provide a runtime stack together with a stack frame for the evaluation of the function call. Then we have to generate a new thread ID, allocate a new entry in the thread table, and then insert the new thread ID into the ready queue. And now if you think of that, if we have single core but a multi-core implementation, where do we have to be careful about? So I kind of mark in yellow everything which is no problem. So the E1 is no problem. Because evaluating the E0 and E1s is no problem. Then allocating a new runtime stack together with a new stack frame. This is the stack of stacks, this is a memory management component which is shared among all threads. So that is problematic, so I make it in red. So this is something which we must be careful about. Generation of a new thread ID, is it a problem? It is a problem. If we have unique thread IDs system-wide, we need a unique thread counter, and that thread counter might be wanted to be incremented by multiple current threads, so that this is a problematic thing. This must be protected. And then this one, allocation of a new entry into the TTAP, if it is a hash table, we then kind of insert something there, and two threads simultaneously might to add something, and then we might run into problems. So this we could kind of, the question is, do we have to kind of protect the TTAP by a single lock, or how would we do it? You could kind of, well, it's a, if it's a hash table, it suffices to, it is better to, and more concurrent if we protect each hash value of the, by a, an individual lock. So that only if two new thread IDs are hashed to the same number, only then we would kind of get a conflict, and so the insertion, so to speak, in the list there, inside for that particular hash, for the same hash value, then we would have a conflict. That means in most cases we would have no conflict. So therefore, this is would be a in that that would be my suggestion for lock ESPs. Because it's a dynamic, in some sense it's... Ah, you mean you write it in that, in there? That's true, we could just... No, and what happens if it's... That's true, we could just... We do would not kind of... So, but... yeah. So it's an insertion and deletion also, because some threads are... The question is whether we will keep... Whether that threads will kind of... stay inside the hash table. If we don't expect that, if we don't expect that, then you are right. We could simply have a separate entry. So it's a, we, the only thing is we have to make this thread table a dynamic array because we don't know. Or we kind of make it in that, that way that we kind of have allow 1024 threads, and if the thread, if more threads are created, then thread creation would fail. And then we would kind of could go with a fixed sized array and perhaps allow a runtime compiler option where one can say, ah, now for this program run, I want to have more threads. So one could go with that. Yeah, you're right. If one has different entries, definitely if it's, if the thread table is not a hash table but an array, we might go without locking at all. Okay, so then we make it in a, in green, because it's it could be that we don't need locking there. And insertion of the new thread into the new thread ID into the ready queue, this is again something which must be protected. Okay. So then now let's see how we do it. So here is, so we here we evaluate the arguments. Here I kind of decided to go in the more conventionally from left to right. First E0, the function, then the argument. And then I do, I have here two things. I have to initialize the stack and I have to initialize the thread. Yeah. And so now this init stack, so how do I, can I get a new stack? Well, we have no possibility so far, so we provide, as we do as usual, we provide a new runtime function, which creates a new stack. And returns then a pointer to the first element of the new stack. So that means here, yeah, so that would be this, the thing. So on top of the stack, then we have a point, in some sense, you might think of it as a stack pointer to the bottom element, which kind of might be left empty. And if that, if the runtime system is not able to provide us with a new stack, then it might, this new stack may return null. Okay, so and then now what does this init stack do? It first provides us with a new stack. Then if it is not null, so yeah, if it is null, then so that is the first thing. I may write it in black. If it is not null, so that the stack creation failed, then we write, we decrement the stack by two. That is, we kind of skip the E0 and the E1 and write minus one in the top of, on top of the stack. So now if everything goes well, then we have a new stack, and then we have to initialize it, and that means we have to put the organizational cells. And so there is this empty, this yellow bottom line of the stack, which is left empty, and then we kind of put the, what is the F? That we will, I will kind of, this is kind of a global point where one might jump to. This is this F. And this minus one is the old stack pointer. That is the old stack pointer, which is not initialized. So therefore it is minus one. And then this S of S on top of the stack, then I put, so no, let me kind of, do I understand my own code? So here is on the value on top of this, no. So no, I, so let me kind of, so here this SP minus one, so this is the value here. This is put SP minus one. So this is the argument art. So this is the argument pointer. The argument pointer I put into the I put here. So here is the argument, and that is kind of here. So this is the A. Then on top of the argument, I put the minus one. This is the old frame pointer, and then on top of that, I put F, which is kind of a global address. And then I afterwards I put the pointer. The pointer on the pointer to the F, to the top of the stack, I put kind of down here. This is the place where the argument has been. So the argument is overwritten with the pointer to the F, and then this this here is kind of popped. Yeah. So here the F once again. This is a continuation address, which is which points to the fixed code for the termination of the thread. So this is kind of the FP old, if you like. And so let me see. Yeah. And then the return value that has relative address minus two. Okay, so that is that we keep in mind, and the FP old in this bottom stack frame, this is this minus one, and so and for the continuation, so that was kind of the init of the stack. So this was the init of the stack. So we have not yet switched to that stack. We have now the pointer to the function. And on top of the stack, we have kind of a reference to a new, to the top of a new stack frame. So that was after the init stack, and now comes the, the initialization of the thread. So this was only one half, if you like. Now, the first thing what we have to do is when we create a new thread is we have to provide this new thread with a new thread ID. And so the question is, how do we get thread IDs? In some sense, so here we kind of use a global counter. So that is perhaps the most simple way. I'm not aware what they do otherwise. So that is, in principle, there's no reason why thread IDs should be 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. So they could be, it's kind of an abstract data type. It could be any other kind of identifier. So in particular, if a thread is created, we could have a separate thread counter for every thread, for every core, you mean. So that one could have. So that means that would kind of decouple the creation of the thread counter, and then we would kind of make the thread ID a pair of the core created the thread and the number. So then the thread ID could be created independently by every core, but then the thread table could no longer be indexed by numbers, but would have to be indexed by pairs, and then it would be more or less inevitable to have hash tables there. Okay, so here, but we use just a single counter to provide thread IDs, and I think POSIX thread would also do nothing else but that. Initially the thread counter has the value 0, and that means that the initial thread, that 0, that is the thread ID of the initial thread, the one which is naturally available when you run main. And before thread creation, so therefore the thread counter points to the last created thread, and therefore we have to increment it before we kind of get a new thread ID. Okay, so here is the situation, how it looks. So we have here on top of the stack, we have a reference to this new stack frame. Below, we have some kind of PC. That is the function to be called, the start address of the function to be called. And then here we have the thread counter. And initialization of the thread will increase the thread counter first. Then it will kind of put in queue the new thread ID into the ready queue, will return on top of the stack the thread ID which has been created, and will then save the current working set for this newly created thread into the thread table. Yeah. So what do we need in the thread table? Well, we need the PC, which is that one. We need the frame the stack pointer and the frame pointer. But the stack pointer and the frame pointer are the same. These are those which have been put here on top of the stack. They will be stored here and there. Okay? So, And then when the context switch occurs, then these three, so I remove all that scribblings, then these three values will move into the corresponding registers, and only then the new thread will start to run. Okay? So here's the corresponding code. If the creation of a new stack frame has succeeded, we increment the thread counter. We kind of save the suitable values into the thread table. That is, what is on top of the stack? On top of what is on top of the stack, we put into the entry 0 and 2 of that inside the thread table for the current thread ID, and for that new thread ID. And additionally, at the value which is just the below the topmost stack cell, that is will go into the thread table at relative address 1. And after that, we kind of decrement the stack, and because two elements on top of the stack will be consumed, and on the lower value we will put the new thread ID, and then additionally we enqueue that value thread ID into the ready queue. And please note, the return value of the create therefore is the new thread ID. Okay? Yes? This is not minus. I think that is, it should be minus minus. I wonder why it is minus and not minus. So it is a long dash, but I guess it should be separated. I guess probably I simply wrote there this one, and Tesh makes it a long minus. Okay, so that was the creation of threads. Now then, there are two. So thinking of birth and creation, so that is the positive way. But there's also about death and and termination. So threads could at some point be terminated, and the question is how. Then there's a regular way how a thread could terminate, and that is if this initial function call f applied to a terminates. And then there could be, then there is a return value, and the return value then, which is returned by that thread, is the return value of the function call. So that's fine. And then, but there's another way how you can access exit a thread, and that is by explicitly calling a function exit. So by that you terminate the current thread. So this is, you can also use if you have a non-multi-threaded code and you write exit somewhere into your code, then this means you go to termination in right away and terminate. Also, you have not, it's kind of an exception which you throw and which terminates program execution immediately. So here in that case, if you do this exit thing, then this E is the value which is exited. And this should be a number. So you kind of, I guess it should be a number. And then this would be the return value of the thread. So in this sense, we have two ways, and how can we? So that means we have to pass information out of the thread back to someone. The question is, to whom do we pass that value? But at least there could be some value which leaves the thread, and then the question is how and which place, which is the memory cell which receives that return value. And the idea is, so we just take the bottommost memory cell of that stack, which has been assigned to this thread. So that is kind of our design decision. I'm not sure whether that always will be the case in all implementations of multi-threaded systems, but here we kind of just take the liberty to do that. Yeah, and for that is kind of... that is the first thing. So now we have made up our minds how to pass that value back, and then if we want to implement that, we kind of have if we have to implement the exit, we have to take care that we kind of must be able to reach this bottommost stack cell. And for that we kind of must be able to pop all the stack frames. And then once we are done with our thread, we have to do something. So for example, what we have to do is, this thread is finished, And then some other thread must be run. So that is, we have, and that is this kind of code which we have to execute once a thread is terminated. This is the one which is available at this address F. So this is the terminal treatment of threads. So here is how I would like to implement the exit function. So if it is exit E, then the first step is to evaluate E to a value. And then, okay, so I have no idea what to do then. Here I kind of have, I have this separated the work to be done once a thread is separated into three again in three instructions, which kind of for me conceptually realize the operations to be done. And these are the instructions exit, term, and next. And so what is exit? So exit is the first thing which I have to do because I have to get rid of all the stack frames. So that is the essence of the exit thing. So it first takes the result, which is on top of the stack, stores it somewhere, and then as long as the frame pointer is different from zero, it puts the stack pointer to the stack pointer at the frame pointer minus 2. This is so where is that frame pointer minus 2? This is not FP old. This SP. Yeah. So in some sense you could kind of think of that here is not required. The SP need not be set here. The only thing what must be set here is you go down the frame pointer, and then the SP of frame pointer minus 1 gives you the old frame pointer, and that you do as until the frame pointer until you reach minus 1, and then you set SP to FP minus 2. So in some sense, this kind of thing could also be moved behind. Yeah. But I've written it in that way because if the frame pointer is already minus 1, then you do not need to set the... you have to... Yeah, so as soon as the new frame pointer is minus 1, then... you cannot set SP to FP minus 2 because then SP would be minus 3, so that would be stupid. So you have to set the to the last frame pointer minus 2, which was not yet minus 1. So therefore, in that sense, this code here is correct, and it's not so easy to improve on it. Okay, so that code is executed, the stack pointer points to the bottommost element of the stack, and then I can say, and then I write the result into that stack frame, into that memory cell. That would happen then, and the frame pointer is. The frame pointer is minus 1. The stack pointer points to that cell which contains the result. So that's the effect of the exit. Yeah. So we go down, and then in the end, the 17 is returned in the bottommost cell, and the stack pointer points to that memory cell. Okay, so now what does the next do? Well, next is something like Next switches the is something like the yield, but with one minor difference: the current thread is assumed to be done. So there's no continuation with the current thread. It's just the next which is activated. So this means the next thread can be found here on the front of the ready queue, and whatever is in the T-tab for that thread, that is put into the registers. And the registers, perhaps that is something which we additionally can do, they are saved. So the current, so at least the registers of the current thread are saved, but then the next thread is taken from the ready queue and initialized for running, because the current thread is now this 13. The PC is the PC of that of the next thread, and so on. So everything continues now with the next thread. So once again, exiting. So seeing, looking at that here, this means here with that, looking at that code, here we have evaluated the E, we have popped the stack, we have the value of E in the bottommost cell, and then we switch to the next thread. So that's good, but there's still something to be done in between. So now there's one more thing. This is still part of the next thing. It could happen that that switching to the next thread fails, because we are in the main thread, for example, or there is no other thread running besides the current thread, and then there is nothing what we can do. But what we can do is we can halt. So if the thread queue is empty, this is could be detected in that way, then we execute halt and program execution halts. Otherwise, we save the current registers of the current thread. We set the new thread CT to the next thread CT to the little CT to the capital CT and restore that thread. So that this is the implementation of that next thing. Okay, so still this term is in the back of our heads, which we have to kind of implement. We will do so once we have looked at another operation, namely that if a thread terminates quietly by just kind of terminating, so nobody cares. But it might be the case that we care about its termination, and that is this caring for termination. This is if we do join, if we join with it. That is an operation which is also provided, also familiar to Java programmers, or Java programmers are also familiar with that, because there you can also do a join for some thread, if you know that if you know the thread ID, then or the thread object, then we can kind of join with it. And here we have no objects, but so we have to provide as an argument the thread ID, and then we can join with it. And so this E should evaluate to a number, which is then interpreted as a thread ID, and then we can join with it. And what do we do? Well, if the thread with that thread ID has already terminated, then we return its value. If it has not yet terminated, so what should we then do? Well, we expect then we wait for that thread to terminate. Yeah? So that the current thread goes to sleep. and goes into so the thread state of that the current thread kind of changes from running to waiting. And so that means the current thread is, and we kind of have to provide a facility of, there could be of waiting for threads to wait in, because there could be multiple threads which wait for the same thread to terminate. And in that sense, we insert the current thread into the queues of threads which wait for the termination of this particular thread. And that means we save the current registers and switch to the next executable tag thread. That is, we kind of remove it from the set of ready threads, and from the current and hope that there's some other thread possibly running. And if there's no other thread possibly running and we wait, then we might wait forever. Yeah. And now the question is, where do we kind of maintain this? How do we maintain that waiting? And this for the joins. And so we have already this TTAP, and we could extend the TTAP by more fields. One field for the return value and one field for the queue of waiting threads. Or we could provide a new tab, which is the JTAP. So I prefer to create a JTAP and not extend the TTAP, but that is kind of a matter of taste. So here is this GTAP. So this is has then two entries. The first entry is the return value of the particular. The first entry is the return, holds the return value of a thread ID here of thread one, and the second is a list, is a queue of threads waiting for that value. And clearly, if the first entry is, if there's a value has been put there, then the queue is empty, because one can always look it up, the return value up, and otherwise it is, they have to wait. So here in this particular case, this scenario illustrated in that by that picture is that the current thread is thread 0 with thread ID 0. In the ready queue we have a thread 1, and threads 2 and 3 are waiting for thread 1 to terminate, and also thread 4 waits for some thread to terminate, namely for thread 3. Okay, and thread 3 could not terminate because it's not yet terminated, because it's waiting here, and here they wait for 1, and 1 could run but is not running because 0 is running. Yeah, so here 4 waits for 3, and 3 waits for 1. So then, now, what would we do? So there is again, so when we translate join E, then we would again first have to evaluate the E to get a value, and then we have to join, whatever that means, and then there is this finalize, and that kind of, these two things we now would have to, our task is now to explain these things. So what is the join? So the join is, I check if on the top of this, the join is called after the evaluation of the argument, E. So that means on top of the stack I have hopefully a thread ID. So then I check whether, how can I check whether the thread ID, the thread with ID tit has already been terminated. How can we do it? Well, we can do it when once the in the thread table we have stored the registers, which kind of give us a hint that that thread has terminated. How is it identified? Well, the frame pointer is -1. If the frame pointer is -1, then that thread has terminated. So that means if the frame pointer is larger or equal to 0, then the thread has not yet terminated. And that means we have to enqueue into the thread queue, which is at position, which starts at position 1 in the JTAP. And then, okay, so that means we have, so we are done with that. We have to, we have enqueued ourselves in there. Yeah, the currently running thread has, so therefore the CT is stored, is enqueued, and then we can switch to the next thread. And our thread state is kind of stored into the TTAP. And we kind of do not enqueue ourselves again into the ready queue because we are not ready, but we just remove us. And therefore, the right instruction to be called here is the next. So here we use just the next instruction. So the join contains the next. Okay, so that was this one. So by that we go to sleep. And after going to sleep, at some point we go to, we will finalize, and that means that this is a situation when we wake up from, this is the next instruction, which will be executed once we will be taken out of this waiting queue and be perhaps put into the ready queue and then rescheduled. So that we have to keep in mind. The finalize will be the next instruction after waking up from the join. So here is the situation, therefore, what happens then. In this case, on top of the stack, we have what value? Well, we have on top of the stack, we still have the... we have not popped it, so on top of the stack, we have still the thread ID of the thread which we want to join with. So that means once we come back to life, we have here a thread ID, so that allows us to look up in the JTAP the value, and that value we put on top of the stack, and that's it. So that's the finalize. The finalize kind of allows us to access the return value of the join. So that was this thing, and now comes we come back to the instruction, this mysterious instruction term, which I have not yet explained, because this instruction term is the one which I go back to the code. Here is the here was the code. For when we do this exit, we have kind of emptied the stack, then we do this term, and then the next. So by next, we switch to the next thread, and what is going for the term? So the term now, this is the last operation which we do before we let another thread run. So here, this is the situation where we can copy the value which we have computed into the JTAP. Yeah. Yeah. And that is also will also. So this instruction sequence we do after the exit, but we also want it to be executed when a thread terminates in an ordinarily. And therefore, we also place this sequence at the location F, so that we have it, so that an exit in the same way as an ordinary program termination will execute these two instructions in sequence. So the next switches to the next executable thread that we have seen. But once again, before that, we have to kind of pop the last stack frame, and the result must be stored in the table JTAB at some offset zero. And then in the additional is, yeah. And then we might kind of mark the thread as terminated. And then additionally, so that more thing, which is even more important, we must notify all threads which have been waited for termination. And this notification of termination and the storing of the values in the JTAB, this is executed by this. This is implemented by this instruction term. And then, therefore, here is these are the operations which we have to do. The time is more or less over. Therefore, we will kind of start at looking at that slide and kind of recalling what the term instruction would do. But for today, I think we have seen enough. Thank you for your attention. We will not meet tomorrow, but next week. Thank you.